Welcome to This Wild Life, a conservation podcast that brings you up to date with frontline conservation efforts from around the world. Expect stories of wild adventures and get to know the characters who are dedicating their lives to protect our beautiful planet. We're here to bring the wild to you. Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the podcast. I've got to tell you, this is actually the last guest of series one, as we are going to be having a little break to start organising series two, pushing the boundaries a little more, and overall finding more of those stories that must be told. If I'm honest, we already have quite a few incredible guests lined up, and we may have already recorded a couple of episodes. We snuck these in just before each individual heads off on expeditions and all over the world. You know, it's so tempting to release them, but we will be saving these for our relaunch in November, and I, for one, cannot wait. Also, we will be back next week for our last episode, and it's exciting because myself and David Grant, our behind the scenes prime researcher, we will both be here reflecting on this wonderful series. Also, it's very important that you stay tuned until the end of the episode, as we will be announcing the winner of the Trail Camera Competition. But now, let's turn our attention to this week's guest, because today we are heading into Alaska. And if you like marine mammals, you are going to love what we are going to be talking about today. Joining us is marine biologist Verena Gill. Verena is a complete specialist when it comes to the northern right whale and a special population of beluga whale who live in the Cook Inlet in Alaska. Verena has an extensive career in research, and we will be talking to her all about her background, giving us some awesome stories from her fieldwork, and also talk about the citizen science program that she is very heavily involved in coordinating. So, Verena, let's get started. It's fantastic to welcome you onto the show, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm delighted you gave me the opportunity to ramble on about my favorite topics.
Yeah, well, the pleasure is all ours. Now, Verena has actually given me a great look at the scenery outside of her house, and it's making me a little bit envious. As Verena, I think you've got a complete view of where the belugas live, I think, just outside your window. Is that right?
I am, yes, of course, because of COVID-19, we're all teleworking. So I'm at home, and I'm lucky enough to live up on the mountains above Anchorage, and I can see where the belugas are having their calves currently over on the Susitna Delta. Then I can see their favorite foraging habitat over at Chicloon. So although I can't actually see them because they're a long way off, at least makes me feel as if I'm kind of a little bit closer to being there, even though I can't be in the field this summer.
Totally. It's awesome. Now, Verena, should we hear about your background? Because I think I'm right in saying you're not from Alaska. So if you wouldn't mind, could you tell us how you landed in Alaska and got involved with marine mammal conservation?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess most people listening to my Frankenstein-like accent would never guess that I'm actually British. I'm actually an American citizen too, but I was born in the UK, and I grew up in Pembury, which is in Kent, just outside Tunbridge Wells. And I had always sort of had a lust for adventure. My parents would take us out every weekend camping. Actually, we went caravanning, and they were very much into exploring the English countryside and very much into nature. And I remember summer holidays after a good game of tennis over the windbreaker in the garden. My sister and I would lay down in the back garden. We rove the flight path of Gatwick Airport. And we'd stare up at the planes and we'd make stories about where they'd been and what they were doing and all the exotic places the people on the airplanes had been and what they'd seen. And I just wanted to kind of explore the world. And I knew that somehow I'd leave the UK. And in fact, so in school, I went to a comprehensive school in Paddock Wood. Actually, I was crap at maths and science. I just wasn't very good. And I was pretty good at English and arts. And my A-levels were in like sociology, geography, and English. But I thought I just didn't have the smarts to study wildlife or something like that. But I wanted to adventure. So I picked a university course called American and Commonwealth Arts at Exeter University. And honestly, the only reason I picked it was because it had a year abroad. And I thought, well, I get to go live abroad. I don't know what I was going to do with it when I graduated. I'm sure you can have a lucrative career doing something. I thought, well, maybe I could be like a foreign correspondent journalist or something. But
yeah.
So I did this program and I got sent to Santa Cruz, California, which ended up being a perfect fit for me. I was there. I was taking wilderness writing classes, just kind of having a good time living in California. And then I thought, well, I'm going to take some classes in wildlife and learn about the area. So I took a class in elephant seals and we got to go out and help do some field research. And that was it. I fell in love. I thought, well, can I be a biologist? I'm going to have to figure this out. Anyway, after a couple of years in California, well, let me add, I never went back to finish my course. Much to the chagrin of my parents and the professors, I kind of dropped out and decided to stay in California, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I wanted to be there. I love watching the gray whales migrate up the coast to Alaska. It was just filled my heart with joy to be there. So after a couple of years of just kind of rattling around California, I ended up in Alaska volunteering to clean up oil and wildlife after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And then from there, I started volunteering on projects. And realized, well, I got to go back to school because, first of all, I never finished my degree. And second of all, I need a biology degree. So, of course, then the dreaded maths and science kind of came into being. But I discovered that when you really want to be something, you're actually good at those subjects. And suddenly I was, you know, getting top scores in math and science because now I realized, you know, I had to do this. This was a passion. So I ended up doing an undergraduate here in Alaska and then going on and doing graduate work actually on Pacific seabirds in Alaska. And then, you know, from there, I developed a career in Alaska that has taken me all over the world. I've been very much lucky, though based in Alaska, I've been to South America and French Polynesia and Russia and just all over the place studying seabirds, shorebirds, and marine mammals.
Oh, well, it's a great story and absolutely shows that you can get into the world of conservation from any angle, and what a career you've carved out. And it's not just the whales that you've been involved with. It's the sea otters too.
Yes, in 2002, I began working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service studying northern sea otters in Alaska, and I worked on them for 12 years, actually. It was one of the things on my career, I again jumped from seabirds to sea otters. In fact, when I got the job, I really didn't know much about sea otters. But as you learn in biology, if you learn about ecosystems and you learn about the fundamentals of ecology and biology, you can apply those things to, you know, pretty much learning any species. It's a steep learning curve in the beginning to learn about that species, but you have the fundamentals. I mean, and the same when I jumped over to whales, I hadn't studied whales before, but if you gain experience in those ecosystems and learning those fundamentals, you can pretty much study anything. So yes, I did. And I very much enjoyed my years of studying sea otters. I think they were, when I moved to California, one of the first things I ever did was I went to Monterey Bay in the first couple of months there and went and looked for sea otters because, you know, they're one of those species that I had always wanted to see.
Well, we will go on to talk about the whales, but perhaps we could chat about the sea otters. You know, we haven't had any other otter-related chat so far on the podcast. So, yeah, tell us a bit about them.
Sure. Well, Sierras, everyone thinks they're cute, and they are to some extent, but my friend, well, a colleague of mine described them as chainsaws with fur because they have exceedingly sharp teeth. And actually, they have kitty cat claws too. They have these claws that they scratch you just like a cat. But they have these, yeah, you know, big teeth so that they can crack a lot of shellfish. And they are the only marine mammal without blubber. And so they have this dense layer of fur, which is why they were so targeted by the Russian and Americans during the fur trade days in the 1800s. And so they can reach anywhere on their body because they need to groom that fur and put this layer of air into their fur. And therefore, no matter where you hold them, they can reach around and grab you. So you have to be really careful. Some of these male sea otters in Alaska are like 100 pounds. You might think of little river otters or something, but these are massive animals, 100 pound squirming fur ball of teeth. And so, yeah, you have to be pretty careful when you're handling them. And we certainly did some capture work. You tag them and we put radios into them to track them. So we have southern sea otters in California, and then we have these northern sea otters in British Columbia and up through southeast Alaska and through Alaska down the Aleutian Islands. And then there are these Asian sea otters, which are, you know, still subspecies, and they reach through to Russia, which is why I ended up doing some work in Russia, doing some comparative studies with their sea otters. But the sea otters in California are listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The northern sea otters, there are three stocks, population stocks, one in southeast Alaska, one in south central Alaska, and neither one of those are threatened or endangered. But then the stock in the Aleutian and Kodiak Island, the southwest population stock, that is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. But we work on all three stocks. And so the story behind sea otters is they've actually been a remarkable conservation success across their range because they were almost extirpated by the fur trade by the Russian and Americans in the 1800s. And in some areas like southeast Alaska, they were completely extirpated from their range, and they were reintroduced from surviving populations in the Aleutian Islands and Prince William Sound. And so the stock in southeast Alaska has gone from zero in the late 60s and early 70s to over 25,000 animals today after they were translocated. So that's been a pretty important and good conservation success story. Of course, there's a flip side to that. And the flip side to that is there's several generations of people that have grown up without sea otters in the ecosystem. And they are a keystone species, whatever ecosystem they are in. Well, in their ecosystem, they actually, you know, change that ecosystem and they cultivate kelp forests. So without sea otters, you tend to have these urchin barrens. Sea urchins will harvest on kelp and kind of remove a lot of kelp, and you have a less diverse ecosystem. When you introduce sea otters, they will forage on these urchins, and so the urchins don't forage on the kelp. The kelp is able to flourish, and you have a lot of forage fish amongst the kelp forest. But the flip side to that is you know, they are voracious predators. They have to eat pretty much 25% of their body weight a day. And if you have an animal that's 100 pounds, that's 25 pounds of shellfish a day. And that puts them in conflict with a lot of people that have prospered from shellfisheries, where sea otters have been absent. There have been macroinvertebrates that they've just been able to harvest. And when sea otters move in, they pretty much denude an area of accessible shellfish. So it has definitely upset a lot of people in some places, both subsistence, people who rely for subsistence on some of these resources, and people that are commercially dependent upon some of these resources. So there's definitely been a conflict in California, southeast Alaska, and somewhat in south central. In southwest, where they're listed as threatened in Alaska, there isn't enough of a population really to put them in conflict. So that was interesting people wildlife conflict that I worked on, and is still ongoing, but of course I don't working that job anymore.
Okay, so that's your past work, but you're working on the Cook Inlet beluga and the northern right whale. So what does your day-to-day job look like?
Sure. Well, on a daily basis I'm stuck in a cubicle doing paperwork, so there you go. I'm going to dreams right now. I think that people, when you say you're a marine biologist, like, oh, wow, that must be amazing. It's like, well, if you like fluorescent lights, computers, and Excel spreadsheets, good job for you.
Oh, gosh.
You need a degree in business to be a biologist. And especially since I work for the government, then, of course, you have all the government bureaucracy. So, you know, 90% of my time is you know, writing reports, looking at data, doing training courses, having meetings, writing permits, and being in the office. Of course, right now I'm at home working. It's, you know, those moments when you're out, in those rare moments when you're out in the field. Although I have a piece of advice. If you enjoy being outside and working with wildlife, don't advance your career. Remain a technician because you have all the joy of going on these fantastic projects without any of the responsibility of working or purchasing equipment or having to go back to the office. You can just jump from job to job being a technician and, you know, seeing all this amazing stuff. I think I had the best fun when I spent several years just in low-paid jobs or volunteer jobs traveling the world doing that kind of thing. But of course, that doesn't pay the bills or buy me, you know, a house or feed my starving two children who would not be very happy if I started just volunteering all over the world again.
Yeah.
But yeah, a regular day is not that exciting. But for the Cooking at Bluegrass, I'm actually lucky to be able to work from my home and not camp for months at a time on a small remote island, which is what I did for many years when I worked with seabirds.
Okay.
So I get to come home pretty much every night when I'm working on Cook Inlet belugas because they inhabit the inlet right outside of my front door.
Okay. And that brings me on to asking about their habitat and what the inlet is like. Yeah, perhaps you could tell us a bit about their habitat and give us an overview of these highly intelligent animals.
So Cook Inlet, you know, I think when you're in Britain, you talk about an inlet, you're thinking about a small body of water. Well, we'll just pop down to the inlet, you know, but here it's massive. And it stretches from Anchorage in the north all the way down to the Kenai Peninsula in the south, and it's a massive body of water. And there are belugas, you know, across the Arctic, and there's, you know, probably 100,000 of them. In Cook Inlet, there are, you know, between 250 and 350. And they're a distinct population segment. The official number is 279, but that's a guesstimate. And that's okay. Down from their historic hive, you know, around 1,200. But they remain in Cook Inlet, and they are endangered under the Endangered Species Act, and they're a separate population. And they do live in a pretty unique environment compared to other belugas. Mm. I don't know if listeners have seen pictures of belugas. Often when you'll see them, they're in the Arctic in pretty clear water, blue, and you can see them well underwater. But here in Cook Inlet, it's like living in chocolate milk. Because we live in a very muddy environment. It's glacially fed, and it's just you cannot see your hand in front of your face. So they're living in an environment where they can't see, and they rely on their acoustics to communicate with each other, to communicate, you know, with their offspring, to find food. It's very much, you know, they're very blind in this environment. Eyes are their acoustics. So we're dealing with that. They're also that high sedimentation, and you're dealing with it as a biologist too. So you cannot see them until they surface, which, you know, as you know, is not that often. So predicting where they are, seeing them or working them with is particularly difficult in this environment compared to other beluga populations. The other interesting thing about Cook Inlet and where they reside is it's a very, very big tide. I think it's second largest in the world, you know, to Bay of Fundy. And so we have, you know, 30-foot tides. So oftentimes, some of the off Cook Inlet, we have Turnagain Arm and Kinnick Arm, which are right by Anchorage. And oftentimes those areas are pretty much dry on low tide with a few channels. So these animals have to really know their environment. They have to know those channels. They have to know where to get out and where to navigate. And they're pretty good at it. And it's amazing to watch them. They will use those channels until the last possible moment. Last year, we were out with them in Kinnickerham, we were following them, trying to work with them. And I was just amazed that they're wiggling out and, you know, 3-4 foot of water, wait until the very last moment. In fact, they got us caught. We were out, Kinnick following them, and they were in these channels, and suddenly the depth was just decreasing. The person was calling like 6 foot, 5 foot, 4 foot. And we're like, we got to get out of here. We heard, you know, we saw sort of like one of the leaders, they're a social animal, and they have these groups. And one of the leaders sort of like signaled to the other belugas, let's get out of here. And they were gone and they could wiggle out. Yeah. Unfortunately, we couldn't wiggle out. And so, we ended up stuck on the mudflats out there for a tide cycle because we had followed them and we weren't smart enough to get out of the right channel. So we had to sit out in the flats, which, you know, at the time was pretty frustrating and a little embarrassing. But it ended up being a good experience because we got to sit there and listen. You know, we had nothing to do but sit and wait for the tide to come back in and float us. But we got to listen to, you know, all the noise that the animals have to deal with in this environment. There's a military base right here in Anchorage and the airports on an army base, and listening to the jets roar over, listening to the commercial aircraft leaving, the private aircraft. We have the busiest seaplane airport in the world. Constant air noise, constant boat noise, constant noise from construction in the port of Alaska. Kind of interesting. And then dealing with the incoming tide, and that's another interesting thing about Cook Inlet and Turnagain Arm and Kinnick, you have these bore tides on certain tides, so these big waves of water come in. Luckily that day it wasn't a bore tide, but it was pretty scary having a big wall of water, as little as it was that day, come in and you know, wondering if it was gonna, you know, tip us over, and knowing that the animals have to deal with that. So it's a unique environment here for them. And I think people have asked us, well, why their population is decreasing? Why don't you translocate belugas from the Arctic, you know, kind of like the sea otters, and put them in this environment? I mean, they're the same, aren't they? And it's like, I'm pretty sure if you took an animal from the Arctic that wasn't used to navigating these channels, that wasn't used to the big tides, that wasn't used to this, you know, very murky water, that they wouldn't survive very long.
And in terms of beluga eating habits, what are they feeding on?
Well, they like salmon is the big fish. In the summertime, they come in, you know, in the spring, they take advantage of the herring runs and the eulachon runs. And then that leads into all of the different salmon runs. So they take advantage of those, which, you know, we have world-class salmon runs in this area. So definitely that's what they're targeting. We're a little bit more unsure of what they eat in the winter. And that's a big question. Are they food limited? And if they are, what time of the year is it? And if it's in the wintertime, I mean, what do they eat? We have some idea of that they may dive, that they do dive deeper and they go a little bit more offshore because they're a very close to shore species. You can drive along the road and see them very frequently in Anchorage. They're a very accessible whale to see at certain times of the year. They're right next to the shore and they go up rivers too. But what they're eating in the winter is not completely clear. So we are conducting studies to take a closer look at that.
And in terms of their numbers, you know, how many belugas are there in the Cook Inlet?
In Cook Inlet, the official count is 279.
Okay. And this is getting lower, hence your research on them, I suppose.
Yes, it has been. It is. They're on a downward trajectory, which is very much concerning. Their historic highs were around 1,200. And it is thought that the reason that they decreased was because of overhunting. But subsistence hunting there was a voluntary moratorium on ceasing hunting in Cook Inlet. And so that stopped. And everyone thought, like the sea otters, you know, you stop the fur trade and eventually the numbers rebound. But with the Cook Inlet belugas, there was a slight rebound for a few years, but they really, they haven't recovered. And now they're actually decreasing, and trying to understand why is the crux of my job as recovery coordinator. Why are they not recovering? And, you know, in order to recover them, we got to understand why. I don't think there's going to be a silver bullet answer. I think it's a variety of different pressures upon them that are impacting their recovery. But we are working very hard to look at, is it an increased death rate? It doesn't appear to be, because the numbers that we recover don't appear to have increased. But it's pretty hard to find bodies in Cook Inlet. It's a swift tide. I mean, it's a big tide, swift currents, and anything is, you know, washed away. It's also a big area where there aren't people. I mean, there are people in certain points in Cook Inlet, but there's a lot of areas where there are no people. So you could have animals wash up and you wouldn't know. Although we do have a lot of people flying around. So one of the things that we do ask people to do is, as soon as you see a beluga carcass, to call us so we can document those numbers, and also to get out there and do a necropsy and understand why they died. And it's really important to get fresh animals. And that's another struggle that we have, that people will call in, but by the time they're seen, they're not fresh. And you really can't glean very much information from a rotten carcass on how they died. And to understand the numbers that have died and how they died is important. So we're grappling with that. These animals, fast enough, people may see them and then the tides come in and take them. Or is it on the other end of the life history spectrum? Is it reduced birth rate? So we're really trying to work on that with one of the big projects that researchers have going here is a photo ID project. A lot of people are used to photo ID projects with orcas, killer whales, and their dorsal fins and their saddle patches, and then with humpback whales with their flukes. But you can actually tell individual belugas apart from each other by their unique scarring on them. There are pictures being taken both from drones above them and from the side, left and right sided photographs, to build up a catalog of animals who can be followed year to year, and calves and associations between animals. And then when those animals don't show up several years, it's presumed that they have died. So the photo ID project, which you can look up, the Cook Inlet photo ID project online, has been pretty good at coming up with about the same decline rate and about the same number of animals, the estimated population from aerial surveys, because that's how we count the animals and look at their distribution also through aerial surveys. So it's a really good technique to follow animals. And again, we encourage the public, if you have a really good camera and you can get really close, you can get as many shots. If you see animals and you're along along the road on the way to go fishing or recreate along Turnagain Arm, and you see animals and you have a good camera, stop and take some pictures and send them into us. Maybe it's an animal we haven't seen for several years and we can add them back into their alive category.
It's interesting to me how you say that there has been a stop on subsistence hunting for belugas, but there hasn't been any bounce back. And you did mention a little bit there about the reasons for that, but I'm intrigued, you know, have you got any more of an idea about why the population is just not growing?
Well, there are different hypotheses. One of the hypotheses is noise pollution. People, you know, will talk about plastic pollution a lot, but I think people don't often think about noise pollution. It's a pretty noisy environment out in the ocean, and in Cook Inlet, that's no different. And these animals whose eyes, who can't use their eyes, and they have to, you know, their eyesight is their hearing, their acoustic ability. And if that is being disrupted by, you know, the sound of a cargo ship, we have a, you know, for the most part, all of our products are barged in. I mean, we do have some things coming in by airplane. You know, you're generally not going to drive things up the Alaska Highway through Canada to Alaska, but most of our stuff is barged in here. And so you have a lot of big cargo ships. And in fact, one of my colleagues has been specializing in acoustics in Cook Inlet and discovered that there's not a 24 hours when there really isn't an hour and there isn't a noise out there of a ship, and that the ship noises tend to be the loudest and the most predominant. And you have that going through. And then, you know, you have smaller boats, pleasure boats, fishing craft, you have aircraft. Some of these acoustic monitors are 100 foot down below the surface of the water, but you can still hear the military jets, the commercial jets. And so, and some of the construction around the urban areas that are on Cook Inlet. And it's pretty noisy out there. And then, you know, and you may disrupt them finding food because a boat goes by and it's noisy. So there is that hypothesis, and it's getting to be a noisier ocean. And then, you know, is it a food issue? Are we seeing changes in salmon runs due to climate change potentially and warming temperatures are definitely impacting salmon runs in some areas? So are there issues with decreasing returns of salmon in the area and it's not enough fish to keep them going? Or is it a winter prey issue? You know, the winter is a hard time for them. Are they finding enough food in the winter or in the spring when they're coming out of a hard winter? Are the Ulacan runs or the herring runs good enough to sustain? So, or is it disease? You know, are there disease we don't know about? I worked on cetus, as I talked about, for many years, and we discovered that mobilivirus, a Phocene mobilivirus that we'd never seen before in the Pacific, that have killed a lot of seals in the Atlantic, actually came over the pole and entered into the Pacific Ocean and began infecting some of our marine mammals in Alaska. So because of that reduced ice and climate change, there were periods of time that animals could transmit that disease, and it made it into the Pacific Ocean. And so there were some novel diseases out there due to climate change that we're seeing in these animals. That's another question. Are there increased predation by killer whales? Again, climate change is allowing, killer whales are one of the so-called winners of climate change because they're able to go to areas that they haven't been before that were icebound. And people may have seen videos of narwhals that, you know, use, as do belugas, ice for protection against their normal predator, killer whales. But now with the decreasing ice, people may have seen some videos where killer whales will go in and just decimate an entire narwhals. Are they doing that with beluga whales? I know historically they've certainly preyed on beluga whales in Lower Cook Inlet, but are they able to now reach them longer periods of the season? You know, before, Cook Inlet was very much ice choked in the upper part, and we're seeing that less and less. Of course, this winter we had a lot of ice, but is that a factor? So there's many different hypotheses that we need to chase down and understand, and it may be the reason they're not recovering is some issue that we can't do anything about for their numbers. So do we, you know, perhaps undergo some restoration projects to, you know, protect the animals that we do have left?
Okay. And in terms of the North Pacific right whale that I know you're also doing research on, that populates one of the areas is the Gulf of Alaska. Now, I believe these are drastically low in numbers. Is that right?
Well, we really don't have a great handle on their exact numbers. So again, a lot of the work is photo ID. You can do photo ID with these animals too. There's a catalog. And it doesn't appear that they're, as far as we can tell, decreasing. They're holding stable. But, you know, when you only have perhaps 30 animals, that's not exactly encouraging. They don't appear to be increasing either. They seem to be holding stable. Their big decrease was due to hunting as well. They are called right whales for a reason, because they were the right kind of whale to hunt because they didn't sink when they were shot by harpoons, so people could easily retrieve them after they had harpooned them. So they were really decimated by the whale industry into the 70s, actually. The Soviet Union really decimated their population in that area. We do have right whales in the Atlantic, too. And there are also, you know, just several hundred of those animals. And they are declining. And then there are southern right whales who are also somewhat in trouble in the Southern Ocean off Argentina. And I've seen southern right whales. So I haven't seen Atlantic right whales, North Atlantic right whales, but I've seen South Atlantic right whales on one of my working trips to study shorebirds in Argentina. I actually was lucky enough to go to Peninsula Valdez and see southern right whales. So I have seen a right whale, but they're definitely in trouble across the globe and up here. North Pacific right whales, I think, are often overlooked, but they're probably the population with the smallest number. And because there's so few of them, we're not entirely sure what their threats are. We can only assume it's the same threats as the other right whales. The North Atlantic right whales are very well studied, and their big threats are ship strikes and entanglement and fisheries gear. And so we believe that's the same threats that the North Pacific right whales face. And in fact, over the last few years, there have been undocumented entanglements in fishing gear and aquaculture in Japan and in Russia. So they're probably facing those same threats. But if we have a body wash up in the Bering Sea due to an entanglement, we're not likely to find the carcass either, because there are very few people out there.
Okay, well, you know, it does show that there is absolutely a problem, to say the least, with their populations. But, you know, for all of our listeners at home, there are people out there dedicating their lives to save them, just like Verena here. So Verena, to summarize your research and the steps you take to save them, you talk a bit about the photo ID, the population surveys. Is there any other ways in what other actions do you take to conserve these species?
So these animals are listed under the Endangered Species Act. And when a federal agency undergoes some kind of action that may impact these animals, they have to consult. It's called consultation, Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. They have to consult with our agency and tell us what they're doing and how it may impact animals, and then come up with mitigations to lessen these impacts. So that is a big part of our job, is to work with companies who are working with a federal agency. An agency may need to issue a permit for a company to do something, and because that's a federal action, they work with us and we have mitigations. So for example, I'll talk about the right whales to begin with. If you have a federal action that has a boat going through critical habitat of right whales or any habitat of right whales, a mitigation may be that you have observers on board and that the boat has to slow down and have a certain speed limit through the critical habitat, or slow down when the observers see a whale. So that lessens the possibility of a ship strike, for example. That is, you know, one thing for right whales. And then for belugas, I mean, it's the same thing with ship strikes. That's an issue too, that I didn't talk about previously. But when there are, say, the Port of Alaska, for example, is doing a big construction project right now to update the port, and there's pile driving. So they have several stations with multiple observers. And when belugas come into that zone of noise, construction has to halt so that the noise doesn't impact the belugas. So there are many different mitigations that you can impose. I'm always looking for new mitigations and new ways of doing things. You know, perhaps drones can be used as observers as well. On a day-to-day basis, when you're looking at conservation, that is definitely one tool in your toolbox you can use, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Another tool is outreach, just letting people know about these animals and things they can do to help us, like citizen science.
And on the citizen science side of things, what is the engagement and uptake of this with the general public? Is it good?
Well, predominantly for belugas, because belugas intersect with human cooking like belugas. And, you know, other beluga populations too, but we're just talking about cooking like belugas here because they are endangered in the U.S. There are other imperiled populations of belugas, like the St. Lawrence population in Canada, but because I work for the U.S. government, I'm working with the five stocks of belugas that we have, and only the cooking lit one is listed under the Endangered Species Act. So this beluga population intersects pretty frequently with people, either on the Kiloff River or the Kenai River in the lower cooking lit, up here by Anchorage in Turnagain and Kinnikahn, which are part of cooking lit. So people see them, and they're very engaging animals. Not only are they next to urban areas, but they're very near shore species, so they'll forage within a few foot of the shore. So why not utilize people to help you, because our resources are limited, both and people and monetarily. So if people have an interest and they can be these citizen scientists, they can be their eyes on our eyes on the inlet, where, you know, we can't be, because there are people constantly on the road in this area, or in boats or in planes. Like I said, there are huge amount of pilots in this area, and if they're overflying an area and they see belugas, you know, reporting that to us is important.
Now, a last question. Verena, what's so good about these species and your work? You know, why do you love it so much?
You know, that's a good question, and I've never really thought of it. It just makes me happy. And I love working with animals in any capacity. They're much easier to work with, you know, and that does bring up a good point. You know, being a biologist, you ask me my typical day is dealing with people, and you have to be a good people manager and work with people and get along with people. So you can't just escape with the animals, which is my favorite thing to do. You know, I just love these big wild expanses. It makes me feel wild at heart, I guess.
Well, Verena, we must wrap it up there, but thank you so much for coming on here today. It's been awesome to hear about your journey into conservation, all about this population of belugas and the steps you're taking to figure out how to save these populations, not only the belugas, but the North Pacific right whale. Of course, if anyone wants to know more, do head over to This Wildlife Podcast social media on Instagram and Facebook to find links to Verena's work and find out how you can support. Again, thanks so much, Verena, and I wish you all the best in your future research. And maybe we'll have you back on in a couple of years to hear how it's all going. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for highlighting the issues and really bringing awareness to people. That's a big part of the job is outreach, and this is definitely some good outreach for these species today. So thanks.
You've listened to This Wildlife Podcast. Now the time has come to announce who has won the trail camera. But firstly, I have to say a huge, huge This Wildlife Podcast thank you to everyone who has supported this podcast along the way and continues to do so. Your reviews have been so amazing and it means so much to us and all of our guests and organisations that have been on here to know that these stories are having a positive impact on your day. So I'm actually sat here with a pot of all of your names. I hope you can hear this. We have got people from Switzerland, South Africa, the United States, Australia, the UK, Italy. Oh, it's awesome, guys, to have you all entered in this competition. So I'm just going to have a bit of a rummage around. Oh, gosh, good luck, guys. Okay, right, I'm picking one out. Okay, let me just unpop this. Right, I've got a winner here. And the winner is Hell on Moon. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Okay, I'm going to have to spell this out. H-E-L-O-N-M-O-O-N. If that is you and this wonderful username, congratulations, you've won a trail camera. All we need you to do is send us an email on thiswildlifepodcast@gmail.com or contact us on Facebook or Instagram and we will organise shipping this trail camera out to you. Guys, sorry if you haven't been lucky this time. We know all of you are out there eager to win. But this isn't the end of the road for our prizes. Next series, we're going to have all sorts on offer, from cars to houses. Okay, David, I think our researcher is currently clutching his car keys with dear life. No, in all seriousness, guys, the prizes will be worth it, so watch out. As always, we love that you're coming on this journey with us. It's a pleasure to have you here. Have a lovely day wherever you are in the world. And remember, we're here to bring the wild to you.